something that's all, it's on all your minds, I'm sure, which is the butterfly. The butterfly, and perhaps you've heard this kind of metaphor before, but I'm going to give you my own twist on it because I certainly didn't create it. And I'd like to start out by talking about that, because with any new start, we inevitably have to undergo some sort of transition, right? And a transition, by definition, it's some sort of movement towards something, a development, a change, I think, an evolution. From one stage to another stage. And that's really what we're doing in the program of recovery. And it's really important to highlight here for me the word change, because that's what this practical program of spiritual action is all about. And I'd like to think that we can learn a lot of lessons from nature, right, about this active process that we embark on in Overeaters Anonymous. So maybe we can examine, some of the movements that a caterpillar undergoes during its transition to a butterfly, because I think that speaks to me. I like imagery and I like, tying things to nature, because after all, the program of action is about change, right? And so one of the first lessons, that I heard is that if nothing changes, nothing changes, right? It seems so simple and yet true. So in order, to come into form, if you look at a butterfly, they develop through a process called metamorphosis, right? I don't know what that means other than change. They come through a process of change that has different stages in it. And each stage is fully dependent upon the other stage. And while the change that caterpillar can at times feel is painful, it's uncomfortable. They go through a period of uncomfortability, that's for sure. Although I've never interviewed a caterpillar, but I can only presume that it's not the most comfortable process. But if we don't allow ourselves to go through all the changes, the stages rather of the changes, that nothing is ultimately going to change, right? Nothing changes. So inevitably what happens is we come to OA and we stay in the same form that we've always been in. And this, to use the metaphor, this inhibits us from flying, from freedom, right? That will come with that change, right? And in the physical realm, when I think about it, that's certainly true. And I would suggest that the same is true in the spiritual realm, because I have come to believe, I didn't arrive here religious or theological, but I'm not necessarily those things today, but I am absolutely spiritual. I absolutely have come to believe over time in a power greater than myself. The other lesson with that metaphor is that everything that we're taking in, will be fuel and nourishment for our new form. And much like the caterpillar during the first stage, the kind of, they call it the feeding stage. I hate to use that term because this is OA, right? But it's the feeding stage. But what the caterpillar does is their job, in essence, from an evolutionary perspective, really, is to get appropriate nourishment during that stage. And it fills itself with nourishment as the food that it eats. And at this time, it stores it and it's used later as an adult. And it's very necessary, right? And the question for me is, am I trusting in that the process of nourishing myself with experiences, with learning, for example, about what I'm up against with this disease? What is the way out of this disease? First, I need to know what the disease is, right? And if it's, for example, if it's my abuse as a child, if that is my problem, then I will continue to search for a way to kind of navigate and overcome those feelings, but that's not my problem. And I'll speak to that more. And I'm not minimizing, abuse and trauma and so forth, but I need to know what I'm up against, right? But, am I trusting in this process of nourishing myself? And am I learning about what I'm up against, as I said, and what's the way out? And once I know that, how in the world am I going to manifest this? How is this going to become manifest in my life? What is the road? What is the pathway towards this freedom, towards this change, right? And this is ultimately feeding my future form as a human being, even in the experiences that are particularly challenging. Because I don't know about you, but I got here And my higher power slowly came to me through my wounds, through my hurts, through those unhealed parts of me. That was the way in. My higher power came that way. And I think the other lesson with the caterpillar butterfly kind of metaphor is the shedding of old patterns are necessary, right? They're absolutely critical. And as the caterpillar grows, you know, what we know is it splits its skin, actually, and it sheds its skin 4 or 5 or 6 times, is my understanding, and how valuable to look at this movement as a really a mandatory process of shedding, of expansion, and this has to occur, not once, but it occurs over and over again, much like our process of recovery. And then another lesson there for me is the notion of solitude. In the midst of the we, there is the solitude to provide space and time so that I can internalize these things and I can allow and surrender through becoming, right? And when the caterpillar is full grown, you know, and stops eating, essentially, what happens? Well, it becomes a chrysalis, right? Depending on the species, the caterpillar may suspend itself under a branch. You've seen that before. And it hides in the leaves, right? And it buries itself underground. And during this time of transition and transformation, because that's what it's going through, much like us, you know, we need too to give our body and our mind the space to go and just be, to and experience surrender organically, because that's what this was intended to be. I know that unequivocally today. This process of surrender, these stages and steps of surrender, right, come upon me. And that surrender, which is really difficult at first, even putting the food down was the first level of surrender. It's challenging. But over time, what I found is it becomes more organic. I don't have to think about it. When I first started driving a car at 15, 16, I had to have my hands, well, it used to be 10 and 2, right? Now I think it's 3 and 9, right? And I thought about where's my foot? And I thought about all the different, you know, the different positioning, and I saw the lines in front of me, and am I staying within the lines? And do you know, when you drive today, probably like me, you don't think about any of those things. It's organic. It just happens. Half the time your mind can be on many other things because it's become a part of you. You've internalized that in much the same way we do too. You know, and what's significant about this stage of the solitude part is it's important for us to own, you know, emotional and personal transition, right? And yet we don't always see the changes that are occurring. Big changes are occurring inside, although I didn't see it. I didn't know how close I was to freedom. I hoped, I anticipated something because I saw changes in you. You know, see, I saw changes in Becky and Karen and this one and that one. And I saw changes and I thought, my goodness, you know, if they can change, maybe just maybe if I trust this process, I can change. You know, and that's difficult. And you know, with the caterpillar, they're now growing rapidly, and they develop legs and wings and eyes and other parts of the adult caterpillar, right? And this stage can last for weeks and a month and even longer. And what's interesting to me about this metaphor as it relates to our program of recovery is sometimes a breaking down must occur before change begins, before restructuring, internal restructuring occurs, right? And during this phase, this rapid phase of growth and change, the caterpillar actually has to break down its parts, much in the same way we do, in a 4-step, in a 5th step, 6, 7, 8, and 9 in the action steps. And they break down their parts and they even liquefy the caterpillar in order to come into this other form that it was intended to be. See, it didn't have to think its way through. A caterpillar can become nothing other than a butterfly. It doesn't have to tell itself to surrender on a given day. It just happens organically. Yet I understand as human beings, we have minds and we think in the past and the present and the future. And sometimes it could be challenging. You know, but can we allow ourselves to let this unfold organically, perhaps detach a bit from the outcome as challenging as that may be, can we try to do that? And if we relate to this process of recovery, this thing we call recovery, it actually means that our body requires, you know, a giving in, right? A surrender or a metaphorical melting into the process, right? There's kind of a melting into the process. And I know that sounds all well and good, but if you're jonesing for an Oreo cookie right now, you know, it's like, well, you know, that's all great, Larry. You know, thanks for the information, but I'm struggling and I'm suffering. And my husband or my wife is having challenges, and this one and that one is having challenges. And I will tell you that I have, I didn't cross the line into freedom in this recovered state of being, not cured. I hope you didn't hear me say cured, because after all, I wouldn't be here if I was cured, would I? Why would I if I was cured? If I felt that I was cured, I wouldn't be here. So somehow the paradox is that I'm not cured, and yet I am not suffering from the effects of compulsive overeating by the grace of my higher power today. I've come into a new form, and this melting into the process, and it continues to unfold. And this is called surrender, right? And however, this movement, this process of letting go something in order to grab onto something else, it actually means for a period of time that we may feel like we're holding on to nothing. We feel we're off track. We're not, you know, that person, if I can only think the way that person thinks, if I can think the way Becky thinks, then and only then, maybe I should hang around Becky and see if I can get a little bit of her something, a little pixie dust from Becky. But this is an experiential process. She'll be the first one to tell you that, right? And so we may not consciously identify what is happening to us during these times of uncertainty, but our body and our spiritual antenna is up, right? And we can sense a change perhaps at different times, and we can have a range of emotional reactions to that change. And so by examining, you know, this caterpillar's physical breaking down of form in order for restructuring to happen, this change to happen, you know, using this metaphor, maybe it'll provide you some guidance during these uncertain feelings you have in program. Maybe you've been in program for 30 years. Maybe you've been in program for 30 minutes. I don't know. But I will tell you that it's going to take perseverance, and it's going to take grit, and it's going to take a willingness to go through sometimes an extraordinary amount of uncomfortability. We call that suffering, right? It's an existential human condition, suffering. What is it about me as an addict that I had an expectation that I wouldn't suffer, that I wouldn't have those things? And what is it about the addict brain, the mentality? And I'm not chastising us. I'm just saying, but what is it about our expectations that our uncomfortability, our suffering, if you will, should be minimal? Because everyone who has ever walked the face of the earth or will ever walk the face of the earth, I know will experience suffering. How do I know that? Because they're human and it's universal, and human beings will suffer at times. But so too is there a tremendous ability for transcendence. And I've experienced that transcendence here, and I'm not perfect, and I'll never claim to be perfect. But, you know, that's this aspect of the program. You know, we you have a sponsor, hopefully, and you're developing a tribe of people, like-minded people that have traveled this path or are in the midst of traveling this down this pathway. And they're taking one step after another, and sometimes two steps forward and one step back along this pathway that we call recovery. That's what we call recovery. And we need to be kind to ourselves during these times of transition, because your body's going through, and your mind and your spiritual sense is going through a new sensory experience. So I reflect on these lessons. I don't know if they're helpful to you, but I reflect on these. Now, before I pose the next critical question, I want to remind you that there are principles underlying all the steps. You probably know that. There are principles, and the principle underlying step one is honesty. Honesty, right? Didn't come very easy for me, still could be a challenge. But allow me to digress for a moment as I say that. You know, I found many silver linings in the midst of the challenges with COVID and other things going on in November of 2020. And one of the things that I found is that there are more people that have access to recovery through Overeaters Anonymous at this particular time than at any other time in our history since Roseanne started this thing in 1960. And when she went to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in 1958 or 59, and she saw hope that maybe, just maybe, this would work for food. She saw some commonality, some consistency in what they were trying to do to have a transformation, a spiritual transformation of mind and body. And maybe this would work for her and others with food and weight and all these different things. Whether you're 80 pounds dripping wet and a compulsive overeater and a restrictor, or you are 800 pounds and you don't know from restricting, right? The point is you have a seat here. You have a seat here if you have a desire to stop eating compulsively. But rest assured, you have to get in the arena. You know, there's many critics. Perhaps you've heard this. There's many critics. And then there's the warriors, if you will, in the arena. Are you a warrior in the arena? Sometimes the warrior is not this bold, strong, muscular person, right? Sometimes the warrior is just a very patient person who's coming, but they are nonetheless, they put a jersey on, they put the, you know, and they get out in the arena rather than sitting back and watching the people in the arena, because that's not going to get you well. I tried to be a person who didn't get in the arena. Of course, I would not have owned up to it at that point. I thought I was sort of in the arena, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. And but that's a silver lining, lots of people. And now with that said, with all the Zoom meetings and all the beautiful stuff going on, folks can still hide in the proverbial shadows, right? Sure, just like when I first walked into an OA meeting, I could sit my butt in a chair closest to the exit, the entrance, the exit, and make a dash, you know, and I often did at the end of the meeting. Not even hanging around to, you know, God forbid I hang around to chat with anybody, because, you know, I didn't want them to know all the secrets and see me for the shame and the self-loathing that I had. Now, I would not have said that back then. I didn't see it that way, right? But are you in the arena, or are you in the crowd watching the people, the patient, kind warriors in the arena? I think that's a big thing that I need to ask myself always. And what do? We speak a certain language. There's not a special handshake to be in OA, but we definitely speak a certain language, and that is the language of the heart. We speak the language of the heart. I've never seen a single person brought into alignment with the higher power of their own understanding by being beaten over the head with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous or OA literature. Never seen that happen. And yet I do see that when we speak the language of the heart and we have compassion for other people, but we're firm, we say what we mean, we just don't say it mean, right? When we do that, people can get well. And I will tell you, as the academic in me, you know, as a psychologist, I'll just tell you, not because I'm looking for any like, oh, boy, Mr. Big Shot here. No, I just want to tell you, because I want to give you a sense as to where I came from, you know, and moving from that sense of fraudulence, feeling fraudulent, to a place of transparency, you know. And I came into program thinking that OA, this OA 12-step deal was kind of like group therapy. It seemed an awful lot to me like group therapy, which I ran groups, and I thought that had some utility and was a good thing. But the disease continued to emasculate me, and the disease destroyed my relationships, and it was destroying my body. And I had no sustainable relationships to speak of. I had surface relationships, many of those. I had clients, patients, many of those, you know, relationships here and there, but nothing, you know, most of them were surface. There wasn't deep transparency. I had too many secrets, too many things that I felt shameful about that I didn't want you to know. And I remember years ago having a professor, this is years ago, in graduate school, who drilled into me and us that if you couldn't measure it, it does not exist. Just this whole idea, if you couldn't measure it, it doesn't exist. And I have to tell you that I learned much later in program, I learned this experientially that suggested otherwise. You know, let's face it, recovery indeed can be messy, right? And it's not always measurable. It's not always measurable. And yet we try to through comparison, which is, I think, very detrimental. You know, for example, how long, I get this question a lot. Larry, how long did you struggle? And I know because I ask those questions too. How long did you struggle? What I was really asking was, how am I doing? How am I doing? I'm not getting well. I may see some changes, but how long until it's my turn? Oh, you struggled, Larry, for 5 years? Okay, whew, I've only been in for two, right? Or conversely, you've been in there for 17 years or 20 years, and you just recovered a year ago, meaning brought to that recovered state. Please understand what I mean there. You know, that recovered state of being where the obsession is lifted. There's neutrality over food, right? Not that you're a perfect human being. You'll never rise above the level of a human being. We're all imperfect. But I asked those questions because somehow I wanted to know, number one, will this work? I want to know definitively today, you know? I wanted like, have you ever seen, well, of course you've seen the original Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And there was a character, Veruca. Remember Veruca? And I'm not going to sing to you, but Daddy, I want the whole world. I want the whole world. And you know what I wanted? I want it now. And that's how I approach program. I want this thing and I want this relief. And you know when I want it, Becky? I want it now. And Karen, I'll wait. I'll put you on a timer, you know, but I want this thing now. And I was confused about what actions to take. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So anyways, I learned something different from what that professor said. And I learned to lean into the discomfort. That was the way out. Now, working the steps, of course, we're going to talk specifically about that. But I had to lean into the discomfort. And addicts don't like to lean into the discomfort. As soon as we feel any bit of emotional and or physical discomfort, we run for Z Hills. I ran for the Oreo cookies. And then I lied when the truth would serve me better. I had 9 sponsors in the first 5 years. I'm not here to sensationalize that or to compare so you can say, oh, thank God, I've only had one sponsor for 30 years. Meanwhile, I'm holding my breath underwater. I have a white-knuckled abstinence, perhaps. So, you know, that's not the goal either, right? But in my case, I had 9 different sponsors. I'd like to tell you that I learned to lean into the discomfort right away as part of my surrender, but that's not true. This disease beat me into a state of reasonableness. That's what it took. And I can't tell you how you bring up that bottom to meet you. I don't know what that'll be for you. How would I, right? But I think with perseverance and patience, I think my higher power needed for me to learn patience. But I really want to dig into this program experientially rather than conceptually, because it's not a conceptual program. It's an experiential program. You want to get to this recovered state that they speak about in the big book. You know, I'll open up the big book just to tell you where it says that. This is, for me, this is the text. I'm not saying this is the only thing I read. I read lots of things in and out of program. I'm just saying this was a roadmap for how to get well, and it worked. So I'd be disingenuous if I pretended that this wasn't important to me. I'm not saying it has to be important for you, but it was for me, okay? And it wasn't in the beginning, that I can tell you. Wow, it just sounded like Trump, sorry. That I want to tell you that it wasn't, we don't take any political position nor outside issues, right? Okay, so I wanna read to you though for the forward to the first edition. Just not the whole forward, because people will drop off. But it says in the forward to the first edition, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women. So there was 100 men and women at the time this was published, you know, up until say 1935 when Bill Wilson met Dr. Bob, up until the book was published in 1939. Those 100 people at that time, approximately. We 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So they're not going to be vague about it. You know, they're not going to be like wishy-washy about it. They're going to be very definitive, right? And so this is an experiential program. They all had to experience it and trust in the process as they were going through it. And that's critical to know, and that's why I'm here. Here's something interesting. And at each hour, I'm going to open it up to some Q&A based on what I share. So I hope, Becky and Karen said that was cool. So we'll, when we do that shortly, maybe we'll do that first, then we'll take a break, then we'll come back. That's kind of how it'll go. We're informal here, right? But here's something interesting about people that I've noticed. When you ask people about love, oftentimes they tell you about heartbreak. And when you ask them about change, you know, they tell you about remaining stuck. And when you ask people about connection with other people, they often tell you about disconnection. When you ask people about, you know, what they're grateful for in life, they talk about what they're lacking. And I'm not here to take anyone's inventory. I got here in much the same way you did, although the facts might be slightly different. I got here on a losing streak. I didn't get here on a winning streak. I didn't arrive into the rooms of OA and said, you know, life's going beautifully. Everything's going good. This seems like a good way to just make things even better. No, I got here with tombstones in my eyes. I heard someone once say that and I stole it. This is a program where we can steal things and we can plagiarize. It's encouraged because we're carrying a message of hope, depth, and weight so people can get well. So, during this process of spiritual recovery, what I found is I ran into this unnamed thing that I couldn't put my finger on that kind of blew me away. And later I was able to speak to it, and something frankly that I had never seen really. And so I found kind of pulling back from the day-to-day 12-step process for just a moment to see what the heck this was that I was feeling, this phenomena, you know, was, and more importantly, what it meant to me. And as it turned out, what I saw was shame. And I'm not here, believe me, anything I say, hopefully if you were to ask me, where is that in the big book, Larry? Hopefully I can show you. I'm not trying to reinvent anything. I'm just talking about my experience. And there was shame. You know, within our character defects, oftentimes there's shame. And as I explored further, it became clear to me that shame is really more closely understood as the fear of disconnection for me. I'm afraid of what you're going to think of me. I'm afraid you're going to reject me. I'm afraid you're going to see and you're going to be looking for the weakness in me. And I'll just clarify that you'll find it. You'll find it in me, no problem, as we would find it in all human beings, right? In other words, there was something about me that if others knew it, that I wouldn't be worthy of connection. And there's something about me that if I'm not worthy of connection with other imperfect human beings like me, how in the world am I ever going to be acceptable to a higher power that I don't even understand and I'm not even quite sure that I believe in? I'm agnostic at best at that point, right? And maybe still to some extent. And what I can tell you about the idea of shame is it's universal, it's existential. Not even sure what that means, but it's evolutionary. It's built into the human DNA. It's all human beings experience, grapple with shame, whether they're consciously aware of it or not. We all have it. And I was ashamed when I was 100 pounds heavier than I am today. And I entered the rooms, you know, years ago, I was ashamed of my inability to form lasting relationships. And I was ashamed that I would park my car behind the grocery store and splay out my food items, my cellophane bags, my bakery boxes and all the nonsense. And I would binge in a place of peace because there was not a car to my right or to my left or anywhere around. Of course, I still, even in the back of that grocery parking lot, would look in my rearview mirror. Why would I do that? Shame. Somehow I felt shameful. And as a professor at that time, I was teaching at a local college, and I would hide in my office in between classes, and I would turn out the lights, and I would binge to get my fix of my heroin foods. Now, I've never done heroin, but I use the imagery. I hope you'll allow me, because I see no difference other than one's illegal and one's legal, right? But I pursued that those foods to in the much the same manner that a heroin addict would pursue heroin. Of course, I never saw it that way, because I could rationalize and analyze and justify all sorts of ways to do what I thought others were doing without consequence. But here's the thought that I eventually had to consider when I was in the fellowship of OA, but not getting well. And I think it's a critical question. I think there's power in questions. Am I building a foundation of recovery on a canvas of truth? Or am I building it upon a canvas of falsehood? Right? Because, you know, there's an old adage I'm reminded of regarding recovery in OA. And, you know, no problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it. You may have heard the sick mind can't heal the sick mind. No problem can be solved from that level of consciousness, because it was the same level of consciousness that fed into creating the problem. Now, all the while, I thought my problem was you. And I thought, I ate because I was abused as a young child. And I'm not minimizing trauma. Trust me when I tell you, I have great empathy, not only for myself as the little boy that was abused, but also for you and whatever traumas you've experienced. But I will tell you with love and compassion, none of those things made me into a compulsive overeater. For after all, there are people that have gone through horrible traumas. And this isn't a comparison thing. I'm just saying, are there not people that have gone through horrible traumas as human beings? And they're not addicts. They don't eat themselves to death or drink themselves to death or get involved in behaviors and in other substances. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't manifest in other ways. I'm just saying I'm a compulsive overeater because I have both the allergy of the body, talked about in the doctor's opinion, and the twist of the mind, the twofold nature of the disease. And I'll just speak to that really quickly. The allergy of the body just means something very simple to me. It's an abnormal physical reaction. When a normal person puts an Oreo cookie down their gullet, their desire for more at some reasonable period of time becomes satisfied. That is a normal human physical response to eating. So anything they eat at all, even if they overindulge on occasion, every time they eat, whatever they eat, at some reasonable time, their desire for more becomes satisfied. Now with me, when I put an Oreo cookie in my mouth, my desire for more does not become satisfied, rather, my desire for more becomes intensified. It becomes magnified. It becomes amplified. And that's not physically normal. And that's problematic. But that isn't the biggest problem. The biggest problem is the second aspect of the disease, which is called the twist of the mind, or we refer to it as the obsession of the mind. And that means that even if I'm not putting my alcoholic food substance in my mouth, triggering the allergy, intensification for more, right? Even if I'm not doing that, like you go on a diet, you're not doing that. What happens is there comes a certain point where I get up, beautiful day, maybe not so beautiful day, it doesn't matter. Could be 30 days of abstinence, could be 10 years. And about the best idea I had all day long was to pick up that alcoholic food substance. It made the most rational sense to me, thereby triggering the abnormal physical reaction. And thus, I've triggered that, I'm back repeating that cycle over and over again. And it says, unless we can experience an entire psychic change, and that is synonymous with spiritual awakening, with spiritual transformation, unless we can experience that as what? As the result of the steps, the 12 steps, that is the program of action. Unless that happens and our heart changes and our mind changes, and eventually our body changes too. Unless that happens, it says the big book in the doctor's opinion, written by William Duncan Silkworth. I know you're a student of recovery because this isn't a hobby for you. You're immersed in this way of life if you're desperate enough. And I'll speak about hobbies versus ways of life. But I need to know what I'm up against. And without the doctor's opinion, the rest of the big book and the rest of the program of spiritual action found in the 12 steps isn't going to make a lot of sense. Not to the point where I'm going to work the steps quickly, trusting in the process, see? Because I'm reminded at its core, this spiritual program of action is, what is it designed to do? It's designed to stop people from eating themselves to death or vomiting themselves to death or using laxatives and then binging or whatever it is, or drinking themselves to death. And when I arrived to the rooms of OA, I didn't know what I was up against. And I know people that have been around, lovely people waiting for their time, for their pixie dust transformation, and it's not coming. And see, I had to confront the idea that food was not my problem. Food rather was the solution to my problem. And how's that so? See, food actually was the solution to my problem in that it was the only thing that numbed me out from feeling much of anything. It acted as an anesthetic, emotional anesthetic, and it slowed down the chatter in my head for just enough time for me to feel comfortable in my own skin for about 5 minutes. And I'll prove, as I'm wrapping up and we'll get to some questions, I'll prove that food wasn't my problem. See, if the main problem centered in my body rather than my mind, then diets would work. And for people like you and me, they don't. They're not sustainable. And if the main problem centered in my mind rather than my body, then treatment centers would churn out amazing rates of recovery, and people would leave there after a month and they'd never return. And that's not the case. That doesn't happen. And if the main problem centered in my body rather than my mind, health clubs and, you know, and exercise and all those things would be the solution for people like us, and it's not. And finally, if the main problem centered in my body rather than my mind, then gastric bypass surgery and other types of things would work for people like you and me, and they don't. And that's the truth from what I've observed. Now, see, when we remain shackled to erroneous beliefs and false barriers, never again considering an alternative solution to true freedom, to cross that bridge to freedom, then, you know, many folks die in this disease. What if they could come to know what true freedom is? You know, what if they're tethered to a false belief of recovering, that we, but the best that we could do is a fight. It's a daily fight. We armor up and we fight for one more day of holding our breath underwater as a means to mastering our willpower. Just do it. Redirect your willpower and your energy, marshaled by your own will, redirect it towards better our desires. And that's not what this program of recovery is. Not for me. That's wrong. That's not a little wrong for me. That's dead wrong. And so let's, if we can from there, I'd like to just open it up to just a few minutes of questions, if there can be, and then we could take a little break, if that's okay, Becky.
Larry, do you have a certain time limit on the shares or the questions?
I'm fine with whatever. See, I can take the time that we're allotted and stay within the time. So if we go a little over, that's great. And then we could take a little 5 minute break or so and then get back in it. I'm pretty flexible.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Maybe there's no questions, in which case we could take a break. Or commentary, I mean, that's fine too.
Deb B, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Deb, compulsive eater. Larry, I heard you use the term holding your breath underwater. Could you explain that? Is that like synonymous with white knuckling? Could you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Great question. Yeah, I use that, and I didn't invent any of these things. There's not a creative thought in my head, to be quite honest with you. But we, you know, we hear these things from other people, and they resonate with us, right? Just kind of centering my camera there. They resonate with us. Yes, that's indeed what I'm referring to. That in program for me, this is my experience. So my experience was that I wasn't getting well. I was working primarily a program of tools, of the handrails to the program of action. So in other words, what I was doing, and then I'll get to the question to tie it in. What I was doing is and it wasn't that I didn't have good intentions. It wasn't as though I knew, you know, the right way to do this versus I was getting mixed messages and so forth. So for example, I thought that program was primarily about the food plan, primarily get yourself a sponsor. And those are all important things. Please don't misunderstand me. I thought the main part of program was to call my sponsor each day at the designated time so that he can take my emotional temperature and I can take his kind of thing. And I thought, and talk about our food, how's your food, and commit my food. I'm not diminishing the importance of putting appropriate boundaries around those things. I thought the program was the tool of the telephone. And if you tell me to call 3 people a day, I'll call 30. And I thought that somehow I would have this pixie dust rain down on me, and then I would be free. And then, you know, there were times where I thought 90 meetings in 90 days, surely that makes rational, analytical sense to me. The more I pour myself into this and fight for this, my intuitive mind told me erroneously that was somehow surrender. No. So what I am talking about to answer your question is, yes, holding my breath underwater is what it felt like for me. Being in Overeaters Anonymous, continuing to not finding entire abstinence, occasionally putting all my alcoholic food substances down. And then when I put them completely down, maybe you've heard this before, when I put them down in an unrecovered state of being, okay, I felt better. I felt anger better. I felt fear better. I felt like punching someone in the nose better. I felt jealousy better. I felt all these things better because I was feeling for the first time. And I didn't have the food to work as an emotional anesthetic, physical anesthetic. And I never dried out as they did in early AA completely. And I did not work a spiritual program of action. So holding my breath underwater was what I think is the description of what I did, and many others I think are doing, is they kind of know in their heart of hearts that they may have been in OA for many, many years. And we don't know what we don't know, right? None of us can know what we don't know. And all they know is they have a head full of program over 10 and 20 and 30 years. And sometimes they have a belly full of food. Sometimes they're still drunk. And I say that with love and compassion, as guilty as charged, that was me. And I didn't know there was another way. And eventually I began to hear some people that said, no, there is, if we can get back to the basics of what this program is, you know, Roseanne, if you remember, Roseanne, I view as brilliant, brilliant woman who started OA. And she built it from her interaction with Gamblers Anonymous. And where did Gamblers Anonymous start from? They built it all. We all connect the dots back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm not saying one has to work the program that way. There's no have to's. You don't, like we've heard it said, perhaps you've heard it said, you can go skydiving. And I strongly and compassionately suggest you pull the ripcord at some point, but it's just a suggestion. And that's how I view this is, you know, there may just be, and there was for me, I thought, you know, in the first 5 years in OA, if this is as good as it gets, it sure is better than it was. Because I had lost some weight, relationships were a little bit better, but I knew when I heard holding my breath underwater, I knew that's what I was doing. Because it wasn't if the other shoe was gonna drop, it always dropped. Eventually I would pick up something. And thus I would trigger the allergy. And once I trusted in the process and worked the steps in sequence, and I did it rather quickly, which I'll speak to that, because I know that's some controversy on that. I'm not saying it's a have to, but that was my experience. Once at that point, I worked the steps quickly, I was brought to a state where the the twist of the mind, the obsession that would drive me back to food was eradicated. It was obliterated. It was gone. Now, I can say that with confidence today. I didn't know it right in the beginning, but I have not found it necessary to pick up any foods. And if you knew me before, at 100 pounds heavier, tearing up relationships, not trusting myself, not trusting other people, there's all manner of things have changed. So yes, to a short question, I'm talking about a white-knuckled abstinence viewed as, you know, viewed as that's about as good as it gets. One day, it, after all, it says one day at a time. So, and the big book says we're not saints. And all the while I read that as, yeah, some days you eat good and one day at a time, and some days you don't. Some days, you know, we're not saints. And they were talking, both of those concepts, if you study this program, they were talking about the spiritual evolution, the unfolding, which is progressive. It's beautiful. But rest assured, there is a place of neutrality where one is free. And once they're free, you know, of that obsession, they can be put to maximum service to their higher power and the people about them. I've seen that. And still be imperfect human beings, as we all will be. So I hope that answers the question. I used way too many words. So thanks for the question. Yeah.
Thanks, Larry. So Sarah, you had your hand up. Did you want to share?
Yeah, hi, I'm Sarah, a compulsive overeater, sugar addict, and I'm obsessed with the idea of being a recovered compulsive overeater. Some ideas that I had were whether that means the obsession lifted or that my eating behaviors changed, or in other words, when obsession comes, I think it through and abstain. Or am I just in recovery? And I know the big book says recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, that I believe that I'm not hopeless anymore. So do any or all of those things fit, or where am I wrong?
I don't think you're wrong in any, I don't think you're wrong at all. I think that, you know, okay, so let me just get this out of the way. The big book does say it is what got me well. So you're hearing my experience, and you can, you know, you certainly can take it. I just deliver a message of depth and weight from my experience. And I'm just one man who got here on a losing streak. So you're talking to one addict. Now, that being said, what I will tell you, the big book is quite clear. They use the term recovered about 15 different times through the early pages of the instructions of the big book. And in each case, they're talking about these gutter drunks that got to a place where the obsession, the twist of the mind was lifted. It was gone. Now, I'm not here to say that every human being remains sober and all that. We don't see that. Because remember, the big book also tells us that when we complete the sequential process, we have this for a lifetime. We have steps 10, 11, and 12. In other words, we're going to continue to take our personal inventory. We're going to continue to expand and enlarge our spiritual life through service and self-sacrifice for others with no expectation of a return. Sure, that involves prayer and meditation, right? But this is the most spiritual thing that I do, is carrying the message and when I feel closest to the higher power of my own understanding. Now, that being said, I am an obsessive person. Most of us are, right, on some level. So where I can relate what you shared, like I obsess over things and I want to analyze and figure out and turn over concepts. I can't see colors in front of me half the time. My sweetheart, Jen, she could see colors and shapes and sizes, and her big book has got color coded and all this kind of stuff, and she's got beautiful recovery. My big book is, well, it's got no color. It's got nothing. I'm a colorless fool. But what I will tell you is that I live in my head, and I accept that. Now, I mention that to you because this over-analytical brain of mine, which may not be yours, is always looking the whys and turning things over. And what I do is part of my surrender is to accept that I'm in a recovered state of being. as the result of the steps. Of course, recovery is a lifelong process. I'm immersed in this as a way of life. It's not a hobby for me. And I'll talk more about that in the next session. It is a way of life. So I guess what I would say is I'm not too concerned with this. If I'm under a delusion, I'll accept that. But here's what my delusion looks like. If I'm under a delusion on what I'm saying and what I'm experiencing. Part of my delusion, going with that for a moment, being somewhat tongue-in-cheek, is that I have not found it necessary to eat compulsively of any kind through trials and tribulations like you've all experienced, COVID, but years ago, the death of my father, my mother has cancer, living life on life's terms. You know, life is gonna happen. The storm is gonna show up. So that's part of my delusion. If I'm under a delusion, I treat people better. I can show up. If Becky asked me to show up, I'm here 15 minutes early, not because I'm perfect. I'm so inadequate as a human being, right? And I'm okay with that, accepting me that way. But that would be part of my delusion as well, is that I treat people better and I show up. You didn't know the Larry that smashed the windshield some 30 years ago at an age when I knew better with my daughter who was a baby in the car seat. I was mad and I punched the windshield as I'm driving 70 miles an hour and then across the, so you didn't know that guy. You know, today by the grace of God, my higher power that I don't understand, I accept the mystery of it all, but I choose to believe. I am in a recovered state of being one day at a time. I'm not cured. If an Oreo cookie magically flew off the shelf, it can be in the house today because Beth eats things. And if it did, I'm being silly, but if it flew off the shelf and magically flew down my gullet, I believe it would trigger the abnormal physical reaction in me. But since that defies physics, thank goodness the steps treated not the allergy, the abnormal physical reaction, rather the steps treated the twist of the mind, the obsession. It eradicated the obsession. And when it left, it's never returned. But my tax bill still comes from 2017 for $12,000. Do you know what I mean? Things still happen that can upset me. I can get resentful. There can be selfishness, dishonesty, but I have a way of living. And the biggest thing for me today is turning my thoughts to someone else I can help. And then Becky and Karen show up and they say, "Hey, Larry, no one wants to hear you, but why don't you come anyway?" You know, and share your experience. So I don't know if that helps, but that's my answer for that. So I didn't mean to dodge it at all, but thanks for the question. Any others?
Thank you, Larry. For time, it's 10:05.
We
have four people that have their hand raised. So it's up to you.
Well, how about we go through those and I'll be able to absolutely, because I think personally that's important. Even if they have points of difference or whatever, it's fine. Probably more so than me talking. So yeah, why don't we do that, Becky? And then we can take a break. How about just four more and then we'll take a break.
Gotcha. So the lineup will be Carolyn G, Dale Ann, Barbara R, and Rick. Go ahead, Carolyn.
Hi, Larry. I'm Carolyn, compulsive overeater. I've kind of got two things. One I want to say, and I do have a question. You say that you live in your head. And I just was wanting to say that, you know, when you give a personal experience, I really relate to that. I'm glad that you shared that you smashed the window. Because, you know, that helps me relate to when I do such stupid things. But my question is that being a psychologist, and I'm a nurse, and I'm retired now, but when I came into the program, I was a nurse. Being a psychologist, was that not difficult to all of a sudden have to just be you and admit that you're a compulsive overeater?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for that question. So I'll just elaborate on being a psychologist. So one of the things, I get calls from a lot of professionals on occasion over the years. psychologists, other helping professionals, doctors, attorneys, all kinds. And one of the things that I think it is that there is this notion that quote unquote professionals, that we have to be very, very careful. You know, we get all this synthetic knowledge, right? And we oftentimes in my experience, you know, we're either placed on a kind of a perch or we place ourselves on a perch, you know, don't we know? And we want to throw all our proverbial candy on the table, meaning what we know. And we try to keep hidden our character flaws for, God forbid, a psychologist. My goodness, in my mind, if you come to me as a psychologist, you expect perfection, not a person with problems. And it's quite to the contrary. I think this is informed, recovery has informed me professionally. It has allowed for a level of transparency and vulnerability that helps other people, just like in program, you know, even as an unpaid volunteer, I'm paid, you know, not only does Becky slip me a 20, but not really, but also I'm paid by continued recovery, you know? I mean, what better deal in town, right? So it's informed me. I can share things, but I know many professionals, and I was one of them. Oh no, I hid. I was as sick as my secrets. Of course, I couldn't hide my body, right? And actually, this message was carried to me by a former, this is many years ago, but at that time, he didn't come to me for his addiction. It was a relationship issue. But in the course of our discussions, in therapy, he talked about being a heroin addict. He lived in Hawaii for a number of years, and he had been sober for 16 years at that point. And he was a big AA Narcotics Anonymous person, a 12-step person like us, right? And he was really committed, and he seemed happy, joyous, and free when I think about it now. Although I couldn't pick him out of a lineup, you know, today, so many years ago. And he was an Ebby for me. He said, doctor, I still look, turn around when someone calls me doctor, I'm looking for the doctor. He said, doctor, you know, he goes, I'm talking about all this addiction stuff and all that. And he goes, I don't suppose you can relate to any of that. I'm sorry. I said, no, maybe I've never done heroin. No, I haven't. I said, but like for me, I wanted to connect with them. I have issues with food. The way you talk about heroin is how I eat. And my body certainly showed that at that time, 100 pounds heavier. It's like, as my daughter would say when she was younger, duh, right? It was pretty obvious. But he said, that's interesting. He said, I think there's something called Overeaters Anonymous. I'm not sure. You might want to check into it. He kind of flipped it on me, right? And I'd love to tell you, as soon as he left, I got on the computer and looked up OA.org, but no, I sat on that information for about 6 to 8 months before this disease brought me to my knees. And today I could be of use to people, especially people that are in that, they'll call me and we'll have many of them over the years and we'll have conversations. But how do you share that stuff? Aren't you afraid you're never going to have a client again? Aren't you afraid of how... And I'm like, yeah, this whole program is about our fears and our false pride. Now, I hope I'm not offending them. I'm just talking about me. It was a lot of false pride for me, and it kept me stuck in the quicksand of this disease. And today I'm free, still woefully imperfect, but I'm free. So thanks for the question on that.
Thank you. Dale Ann, you're up.
Yes, my name is Dale Ann. I'm a compulsive eater. I'm an over and under. And most of what I was going to ask has been answered. But what I wanted to say, Larry, is that I love the butterfly metaphor and that I'm hearing it throughout everything you're saying. I'm still hearing how it relates back to that metaphor. And what I want to say to the committee is how much I like hearing personal experience. I like hearing a speaker. Some of the other speakers have been about how to get down in there and do the steps or, you know, the spiritual aspects and how we can do that, which I need also. But when I hear personal experience, that really touches my heart. It opens me up. I could go through the whole butterfly metaphor for you. And I'm like, I just really am relating to your shares. And so I wanted to thank you. And that's the main reason I raised my hand, is to say thank you for sharing so personally. I think that when we share personally, we connect. And that's something you've been talking about that, about how that shame is about that fear of not being able to connect or be part of. And I'm also hearing you talking about the spiritual, which to me is the unfolding of the butterfly wings. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I wanna say what I always say today, because it's just in my heart. Thank you for noticing God's handiwork. I'd love to take credit, but it's all through the steps. I had to do some work, but it's all my higher power's handiwork. Yeah, today. So no one was looking for me back in the day, I can tell you that. Not in my family, not anywhere. So it's kind of nice to hear that feedback. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Barbara, you're up. You're still on mute.
Okay.
There you go.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I too was struck by the butterfly metaphor, and I have heard it obviously many times. But what really caught my attention, and I just want to say thank you for this, is that I didn't know how close I was to freedom. And that just spoke to me so powerfully. And I'm so grateful for that. So that's it.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a pleasure. It's an honor to carry a message of some kind. So is there another one, or are we taking a break?
We have,
I think there
Rick.
Might be another one.
One last one.
Oh, Rick.
Go ahead, Rick.
Hey, Larry. Hey, everybody. Hey, Rick. Hello. I'm Rick J. I'm a recovered but not cured compulsive overeater in Cary, North Carolina. And yeah, good to see you and hear you, Larry. Yeah, I was too, like everyone else, you know, I was really moved by the the butterfly effect. And you know, and I see that, you know, certainly is a transformation. And when I look at, you know, pictures of myself from, you know, several years ago, and I see, you know, I can look into my, you know, the image of that man and the eyes there, and I just seem dead on the inside, and, you know, and I feel so much more alive and connected now. And one thing I was thinking about, you know, with the with this transformation, you know, is the promises that are sprinkled all throughout the big book, you know, and it, you know, it, for me, the promises are simply just ways that we are transforming and changing. And I just wondered if there was like, you know, like one promise for that you have this really, that just means the most to you, that on a daily basis that you see this promise really working very powerfully in your life. Just one of the promises anywhere in there, just one that's the most special to you.
Thanks, Rick. And Rick's one of my great teachers. We trudge together. So I appreciate you being here, Rick. Not only because you're a man, and it's good to see we got to be represented too, right, Becky? So that's great to see, Rick. And so many promises embedded in these steps. And of course, we always focus, you know, Rick, we focus on the ninth step promises in that phase, and then the 10th step promises. So I tend to gravitate towards those, although there's so many. Couple ones that are one in particular, you know, it talks about how, you know, when, and I'm paraphrasing, when we complete this process, this 12 step process, we trust in this process, hopefully, to the extent that we can. It says in the promises that the problem will be removed. ED, right? Problem will be removed. The question really for me was, when I would read that, still, you know, not getting much better, not feeling much different early in recovery, was, I'm not sure that I understood what the problem was, because I thought the problem was food and my heavy body. That was the problem as far as I saw it. I really compartmentalized the problem. And that's what brought me to OA, perhaps the same for you. There was unmanageability, but I rationalized and rationalized a lot of that away. And I compartmentalized that stuff. But when I heard and then later experienced that the problem is removed, it no longer exists for us. Now that can see, you know, that can seem like, well, where's the humility in that, Mr. Big Shot? The problem has been removed? Boy, that's a bold statement. But when I further understood what problem they're referring to, yes, one of the problems was the obsession that led me back to the food over and over and over again. Certainly that was problematic. But the problem, it says the root of our troubles is selfishness, self-centeredness, right? I had to move in order to overcome this problem. It wasn't a flip the switch sort of thing for me. It was kind of a dimmer switch kind of evolutionary process. I had to move from a self-centered existence, self-absorbed existence, to an other or God-absorbed, God-centered consciousness. And when that began to occur, yes, the problem was removed. And then it didn't mean that I graduate and everyone come to my graduation, because as I've heard it said, if I invite you to my graduation, it is very likely it's going to be at McDonald's or probably something like that. So that's not the graduation. There is no graduation. When the problem was removed, that is the very beginning in which I can immerse myself in this way of life that's not a hobby for me anymore. It is just an organic way of life that works when you work it. So that one is a very simple statement, Rick, but that's the one that comes to mind for me. What about for you? Is there other promises that really jump out for you?
Oh, thanks, Larry.
Because I want to learn from you.
Well, in the ninth step promises, and I love that the problem will be removed. It no longer exists for us. We're not fighting it. But I think for me, one of the things that really, it's sort of like a bookend on, you know, the ninth step. It's we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And then bookended on the other side, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And I kept trying to transform myself. I tried my broken brain, my broken mind kept trying to fix myself, you know, through all the tools I had in my toolbox. Self-will, run riot was my big go-to. So I had one big giant hammer and that's all I had, you know, and now I'm just so grateful that I do have this spiritual toolbox that, and when I use those actions, of course, that I'm taking, that, that transformation can keep continuing. And I think for me, that's what this is all about, you know, in 10, 11 and 12, you know, I see where we're continuing and we're improving and we're practicing. For me, those key words out of the 10, 11 and 12, you know, having had this transformation, now what do I do with that? And I was really good at resting on my laurels, you know, forgetting that I'm not cured and going back. It's taken me 25 years to get a year of abstinence. So that tells me right there that, you know, I've been broken for a long time and to be healed and to be transformed. I don't want to lose that again. And it's just, that's why I love hearing you share and the other people that are, on this wonderful meeting today. So anyway, thank you.
Yeah. I'll say, Rick, cause I think that was the last question, if I'm not mistaken, for this round, but, it occurs to me like picking my favorite promise, you can relate to this probably more so than me. It's like picking your favorite child. Now that's easy for me because I only have Beth. So that that's a pretty easy one. But you know, there's so many promises, not only in the, you know, all throughout the book, there are promises that, you know, and it's just beautiful to see them unfold over time, you know, it's so cool. So yeah, thanks a lot for that question and for being here, Rick. I appreciate it. All right. Should we take a break or do we have maybe till 10:30 Mountain Time or something? What do you think, Becky?
I think that's a great idea.
Is that okay till for about 9 minutes or something like that?
Yes. Be back at the half hour.
Yep, sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Becky, I have a question. Oops, she's gone.
I heard you. I heard you right at the end. What's up, Dale Ann? Oh, you're on mute now.
Okay.
There you are.
What I wanted to say is I know that Judith H. is here on the phone. And can she raise her hand? I don't see her on participants. I just see her phone number. Is that something we need to solve, or do you know the solution to that?
I believe, Judith, if you hit *6, you'll be able to raise your hand.
Okay. I might just call during the break and tell her that.
Oh, that would be great. And if that doesn't work, have her jump in. I'll be happy to.
Because it's just a house phone. And
What I always do,
because I'm missing the fellowship here, is I tend to call someone on the break.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Okay, well, I'll see you in 7 now.
Okay, I'll be right back.